You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com.
This is episode 96 for the 6th of April, 2017.
I'm here with Don Blakesley at the meeting of the Society for American Archaeology in Vancouver, Canada. And he is from the Wichita State University, and he works on a fascinating site. Don, thank you for joining us this morning, and I can't wait to hear about the site. So tell us a little bit about your background and the project you're working on.
Okay, well, as far as my background goes, I have spent a career in plains archaeology, worked everywhere from Montana and Wyoming down to Texas, and from Colorado and New Mexico into the Midwest. So my whole career has been here. Usually I worked on sites that are a bit earlier than the one we're dealing with now, which is proto-historic to early historic in age.
Nice. So this site is being proto-historic. What was the date that you're looking at?
Well, we have radiocarbon dates already that give us a general range. People settled there in the 1400s, I think beginning around 1425, and they left early in the 1700s and began moving south. So about three centuries of occupation.
Nice. And the way you described the site the other day when we were speaking really, really fascinated me. So let's hear the description of this site in your own words, because I don't want to give it away, because it just really grabbed my attention.
Yes, it's at the meetings here, there are several sessions dealing with what are called megasites. It's a new category that archaeologists have invented to cover just this kind of thing. So they're not villages, and they're not really urban in any way whatsoever. So ours, we know from eyewitness accounts from 1601 AD, covered at minimum, five river miles on both sides of the Walnut River. People were assigned to count the houses, and the sort of the consensus number was 2,000, with 10 people per house, a population of 20,000. But the records are such, and where the Spanish went, they missed a chunk of the river. They had to travel away from it, and when they came back, they discovered more town. Wow. We don't know yet whether it's continuous in between or not. That's going to be one of our survey projects.
Excellent.
But if it is continuous, then it's 14 and a half miles long.
Nice. So what is the cultural affiliation of this site?
These are ancestral Wichita. They occupied a very large chunk of Kansas at the beginning of the historic period. Their territory is what Coronado called Quivira. And so Coronado in 1541 ended up sort of the northern end of Quivira. Oñate in 1601 got to the southern end. And we have settlements all across a large area, towns probably like this one, plus a large area where we get campsites. So the total area, I did a comparison, is somewhat larger than the Republic of Ireland.
Wow.
With a population, I can give you a minimum population of 100,000 people. Sort of maximum might be 250,000. Somewhere in there. That's for what the ancestors of today's very small Wichita tribe.
And so the other day when we were speaking about this, you had spoken about the population density and what your findings imply about Cahokia. You suggested that perhaps Cahokia's estimates are a little bit too conservative.
Yes.
Larger.
I worked at Cahokia when I was a student, and at that time, one of my classmates was using several techniques to come up with population estimates, and he was getting answers around 40,000. And then in subsequent years, people kind of whittled that down, but Downtown Cahokia covers 6 square miles, and the neighborhoods, when they were occupied, the houses were densely up against one another over larger areas than in our site. So I think we really need to go back to that 40,000 estimate at least for Cahokia.
That is amazing. Max, was there anything else you'd like to say about the site you're working on?
Well, yes, we have already achieved some understanding of the structure of the site, thanks to new translations of the old Spanish documents. There's a project out of Berkeley called the Cibola Project, which a team of linguists retranscribed and then retranslated all of the earliest documents from Spanish New Mexico, including those of this expedition. And as a result, we have 5 eyewitness accounts, each somewhat different, but all in general agreement. The units of the site were clusters of houses, tightly clustered together, 30 to 40 houses per cluster, with cornfields and other agricultural fields between the clusters. Maximum distance between clusters was about 1/4 mile, somewhere less than that, with very narrow pathways between the fields. One of the absolutely, for me, interesting aspects is, given where the Spanish traveled with respect to the site, they were describing upland agriculture. Now, upland agriculture on the Great Plains, there's only one other record I know of where that was practiced, and that's a much later site further north. We don't know how they were doing it. Prairie sod is difficult to deal with. Upland prairie soils are heavy clays. You can't work them with bone tools, but we don't have stone hoe blades or anything like that. So far, we don't have a clue.
That is a really interesting problem. So would that suggest that perhaps upland prairie agriculture originated at this site?
No, not necessarily. I've just been looking at some other data, and there is a switch reflected in the artifacts regarding how people were doing agriculture. Earlier complexes, they were doing essentially slash and burn. Okay. Forest soils are very easy to work. You girdle a tree, it dies, you can plant around it. The tools for that are gypstone axes and celts, sometimes groundstone. And the numbers of those drop off dramatically in the proto-historic period when we have loads and loads of evidence of agriculture. So they're doing something different, but exactly what, we don't know yet.
Gotcha. So we don't know exactly what the different thing was. Do you have ideas about maybe pressures or influences that might have caused that to develop?
No, not yet. What we do know is that the early 1400s were a time of massive social reorganization all across the southern plains. It's the time frame, roughly 1450 AD, when you can recognize the various Cadoan groups emerging. You can see that you know who they are at that point. So there's a huge region where people had some mass migrations and other things going on, and we're not used to dealing with stuff at that scale. What could have caused that kind of thing? I don't know when we'll have a... You have to come up with a hypothesis before you can test it.
Definitely.
I don't have one yet.
But you are about to undertake a lot of work on this site. Are you at liberty to describe some of the details of your undertaking?
Oh, yes. What we're doing is two things. We're going to be doing field work this summer. We have a month-long field school, and my people will be joined by the University of Colorado Field School for the second 2 weeks of our session. And we are going to be sampling a single trash mound to get specimens of all sorts for protein residue analysis, phytolith analysis, pollen analysis, ceramic residues analysis, you name it. We're going to be selective in which things we get. Mm-hmm. We have already looked at the chipstone, and they almost everything falls into very nice, neat categories of kinds of tools in terms of form. Mm-hmm. And I have hypotheses about how they were used, and we want to, before we go any further, test those ideas. The other thing we will be doing is taking advantage of a former project. It was a massive salvage operation that affected part of the site back in the 90s that was grossly underfunded, and 80% of the excavated material is awaiting processing. And so we will borrow some of that. And when it gets too hot in the afternoon, we'll be in, I hope, an air-conditioned building, processing this stuff so that we can, we need to sample this site in a variety of ways. And there's no reason to do more digging than you have to if the samples are there for analysis.
Yeah.
So between clusters, across clusters of houses, we don't know the nature of the groups of people who occupied those clusters, whether they came originally from different places or not, whether they had specializations within the economy or not. Mm-hmm. And then the accumulation in a single cluster, the storage pits, when they went bad, they'd fill them with trash, normal kind of thing in archaeology. So the accumulation of storage pits within a cluster is giving you samples across time within a single group.
Nice.
So that's where we're headed with that kind of analysis.
That is a really interesting approach. And the one thing I didn't catch as we were introducing the site, do you have a name for it?
Yes, we're actually very lucky. There was a battle fought at the site.
Okay.
And the Spanish came away with one adult male captive, and he was questioned the next year down in Mexico City, and he said the name of the place was Etzanoa. So we have a name for the site.
Nice. So look for Etzanoa as you're reading about the work that Don's about to undertake this summer. And you, we were speaking with Ron Pettigrew of the Archaeology Channel the other day as well, and you've done a documentary on that. What's the name of the documentary?
Okay, the video is called Conquistadors on the Plains, and it covers in part this site and in part some work we did another site, same time period, further north in Kansas.
Okay, so it provides like a regional context for
yes.
this site. Cool. Well, are there any other details you'd like to talk about for the site?
Send money. We are in the process of raising money. This is a public archaeology project. We're going to be doing research, but the local folks have formed a local conservancy with the intent to purchase portions of the site and preserve it. They'll be working with the National Conservancy. And we will be working with the local school system and the local museums to educate the public with regard to all of Kansas prehistory and this site in particular.
That is really important. So if people do want to send money and support, what would be the way to do that?
If they just look up Etzanoa, we have a webpage
okay.
already up. It's just practically a skeleton at this point, but
gotcha.
There is a donate button.
Nice. I'll be sure to include that on the show notes. This will be available on archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, and we will be distributing it widely on social media. So share it if you find this podcast, and send money to the project, because this is going to be very important.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Don.
That's it for this episode of ARC 365. Please share this episode on your social media sites so others can have fun and learn about archaeology too. Please consider a donation to ARC 365 by sponsoring an episode for just $35. You can find the sponsor page at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/sponsor-ARC-365. Thanks and have a great 2017 with the Archaeology Podcast Network. The song Storm Diggin' was written, performed, and recorded by Steve Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.